Bold. Brave. Her. With Dr. Pam Peek.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode number 513 of the Bold and Brave Her podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Allison Pugh, and she's the author of such a title, The Last Human Job. Okay, all right, she's going to tell us in about a second. She is a research professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University, and this is her fourth book, and the subtitle is The Work of Connecting in a Disconnected World. Oh, come on now. We're not that disconnected. All right. Well, maybe we are. Okay. Allison, why did you write this book?
I wrote this book for a bunch of different reasons. But one reason is to give people a vocabulary to talk about work that is not really recognized, not trained, not rewarded, not kind of even measured. Nothing. It happens. It's crucial work. It's what I'm talking about is something I ended up calling connective labor. And that's the work of seeing the other person and having them feel seen. And it underlies so much important economic value in the world. And so I wrote the book partially to give people a chance to talk about it.
Well, did your research push you there? I mean, were you seeing things in the work that you were doing that really compelled you to say, well, wait a minute, there's a thing here?
Yeah. I mean, the proximate cause was I wrote an article in 2012 that made a big splash in my discipline. And it was all about how to do in-depth interviews. And it was essentially fighting. I was entering a kind of academic fight between people who were saying, there was a whole bunch of people saying at the time that the way to get what people really think is to ask them in surveys, because then they don't have the time to kind of make up ex post facto rationalizations, which is what in-depth interviewing gets you, according to this idea. And I was just so kind of struck by what I thought was a totally misguided view, in part because I thought they were really reducing what happens in depth interviews, and which is really a mutual achievement between two people where I'm like seeing you as best I can. And then you're like, well, that's not quite right. It's more like this. And I'm like, oh, how about that? You know, like, and after I wrote that, I started to think, well, what other professions do this? And I started to see it as a kind of clinical practice taught by apprenticeship. And I started to see it everywhere. I started to see it in obviously therapy, obviously nursing, but also teaching, primary care, my hairdresser, my kid's soccer coach, the lawyer, the real estate agent. You know, I started to see it everywhere. And that's really the beginning of the book.
Yes, I was reading this book, which is absolutely fabulous. And it's your stories are really rich. So, you know, I had to sometimes sit with it for a minute as you parse this out. And since I'm a physician, I also really felt it really resonated with me. And I know it's going to resonate with my Herb podcast audience. And that is, how often are you really seen in life? How often do people respect your very existence to do an eye-to-eye type of interaction versus mumbling and looking at the floor or just
or
shuffling by? Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So your book, I'm going to melt it all down to a couple quick little things. All right. I love simple, sexy, sticky sound bites. Okay. That's how this is something someone taught me in television a long time ago. And that is, how do you remember this? I remember your book as a book about seeing people, about really seeing them. And in doing so, doing the work to connect, which is the connective labor. Did I get that right?
I mean, sure.
Okay.
I mean, to me, obviously, the connective labor is really the seeing. I mean, that's what that is. And you asked, how often are we seen? And I want to I agree with what's behind that question, which is like, not very often. But it's also true that I want to push back a little bit because it doesn't have to be perfect. There's actually a lot of research that shows that like people can kind of get it partially right. And really just the fact that they're trying goes a long way. So yes, our capacity to see the other, there's so much getting in the way of that. And when I talk to people in audiences across the country, often they tell me when they haven't been seen, they tell me about misrecognition. People really remember misrecognition. Those are very powerful moments of not being seen. But at the same time, as long as you have a kind of relaxed view of like how perfect it has to be, people will go a long way to meet you halfway, basically. You can, and also if you make mistakes as a seer, I'm speaking to nurses and physicians and et cetera. If you make mistakes and you try, you say, I don't think I quite got that right. Is it more like this or that? That therapists know actually goes a long way towards making people feel like you care, feel partially seen in that effort.
So you're talking about reflective listening.
Sure. Yeah. The only thing that is different, and it's a minor difference, but to me, there's the world in that tiny difference, which is it also has to be received by the other person. So it's not just the skill or whatever that adheres to the individual. It's not emotional intelligence. It's not, you know, there's a lot of words that are trying to get at that. It's more like closer to like what therapists call the therapeutic alliance or something. It's about what happens between people. And there's a lot of reasons why that's important.
What are those reasons?
We have like a ton of words already for, why do we need another word for reflective listening? No, thank you. But another reason why it's important is because of AI. Because AI is actually, it turns out, not terrible at making the other person feel seen. People, humans, give the benefit of the doubt to computers. They will feel seen if the computer does very little, actually. And we've known that for years. There's a very famous case of a computer, a program that people called Eliza in the 60s.
I remember.
Yeah. So that where like grad students would be like sneaking in and talking to it because it made them feel seen. And so computers can do this to some degree. I mean, I can tell you how I think it's only partial and not that great, but humans give the benefit of the doubt to the not that great effort by the machine. And what we're losing or what's at risk is what's actually between people. That's what matters. That's what I want us to pay attention to.
Is that why you called it the last human job? Where did that come from? That was another rich piece of the book.
Yeah, I think it is the last human job. There's been more than a century conversation about like kind of what can machines do and what can humans do. And that's been a moving line as people go erase that line once they discover that machines can do what they thought it couldn't do. So if in the beginning, maybe we thought, oh, machines can do kind of manufacturing work, but they can't do cognitive work. And then, you know, calculators, computers, you know, like it becomes clear that machines can actually do cognitive work. So then you get to like, no, machines can do cognitive work, but they can't do creativity. They can't do the synthetic work. That's the uniquely human capacity. Well, actually, we find ChatGPT, that can do creative work. Now, the creative work is sometimes people would think it relies on plagiarism, kind of non-cited prior material, and that causes a lot of angst and horror.
But that's its only memory, because that's what you fed it. You fed it all those other data bytes from 28,000 people's writings and whatever. And yes. So it's going to draw upon those data banks.
Yes. And while that was also true of like your average search engine, that did a little more citation so you could follow where it was getting it. And it's the black box that is kind of a problem with the new large language models. But in any case, what they're doing is creativity. If creativity is like kind of bringing things together to produce a new thing, that's really often or sometimes what these large language models are doing. So we have to rewrite the line. And I think the line is what humans do for each other. And that's connecting and connecting with other human beings. And that's really not mechanizable, not automatable. If you go back to like, maybe it's a skill and can we, you know, seeing the other, that is automatable, but what's not is what happens between the people.
Yeah. You know, I never fully appreciated that until about a year and a half ago, I moved south away from the big city and I had to go back to the big city to speak at a science conference recently. And oh my God, you know, the heads that are bowed, the heads stuck in any kind of device, whatever, wherever you go, no one looks at each other. I'm being totally global here. you know, eye to eye. I found it to be exquisitely disarming because I didn't fully realize that I was swimming in that for so long in a more urban environment. And where I am now is, I mean, people look at each other, they smile, they connect with their eyes. And, you know, at first I thought, oh my God, I can't deal with this, you know, this is too much. They're actually connecting with me. And then, you know, you start warming up to it and you expect it after a while and it feels good. It feels good. That connection, right, is good. And then all of a sudden, I'm doing connective labor. I'm putting it out there to go out of my way to do things with people and, you know, total strangers.
That's
I'm walking down the street or hanging out in a restaurant or doing whatever. I just find it fascinating that I find that so human to do and I missed it. And so the entire week I was in the urban area, it was few and far between, other than just typical interactions, reception at the hotel desk and ordering something at a nice restaurant, you know, that kind of thing where you obviously have to have some connection there. But that's transactional. That's not different, which is, you know, something sweet and a little bit richer and more meaningful. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, there's actually some really great sociology written about kind of urbanization and why that happens, what you're describing. And I actually find it useful because it's not that you go to an, you move to an urban setting and you're all of a sudden you take an unfriendly pill or it's in the water. It's actually how people preserve their privacy in a place of extreme, of higher density. So if you kind of were that open to everybody, you wouldn't be able to control who's around you. That's number one. And number two, in an urban environment, you kind of have more choices. So you can kind of be more selective about who you're aiming your warm feelings to. So you can be more like, it's not just, oh, I know this person, I've known them for 30 years and we may not be perfectly matched, but I've known them a really long time and there's a lot of history there. So, you know, this here I am being friendly. It's more like this person shares my exact interest. And so it's someone that I've found in this city of 8 million people or whatever. That said, what you're describing, that sociologists are really really explaining what your experience was. And it's really true that urban environments really promote kind of this kind of a little more closed off and more efficient transactional interactions. And there's actually great work by this fantastic psychologist in England that shows that if you turn down a little bit of that efficiency, it's actually better for your well-being. So if you're friendly rather than entirely transactional and efficient with your barista or with your waitress or with your, you know, low-wage retail, you actually benefit. They found psychological benefits. Your well-being improves. So yeah, we should all be a little bit more rural.
I just love it. I'm sort of like injecting the rural into the urban, and I'm trying to find I just avoid that damn word balance. I try to find like, it's just like, no, not balance. Something like a hybrid, something that just sort of feels a little bit better. I'm just so much more now sensitive to saying something wonderful to a barista who's like going out of their mind with a long line behind me and all the rest of it.
And I do the same.
It makes me feel good.
And them.
Because it's more than just slapping a dollar in the tip jar.
Right.
That's an easy out. Instead, what I love to do is just take 5 seconds, just say, man, this line couldn't get longer. I mean, are you guys like giving this stuff away free or what are we doing here? And then they laugh and they go, okay, someone who's a human being, OMG.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that interaction. And you never know who you're hanging out with. I think some of the most fun is when you're flying. And who's sitting next to you? Who's sitting across from you? What's going on? I ended up with a guy who just clearly was a 6'4" athlete, kind of humanoid, who was older, but it was just so clear. I was going NBA or NFL, right? And he was sitting next to me on the way back. And it turns out he's one of the big NFL coaches. He's now retired.
Oh, really?
He used to be a tight end with all kinds of famous teams and all that. And we ended up having a blast because I kind of looked over a little bit and I saw that he was typing away at something that I thought might be a speech or something. And since I'm a writer, I kind of like, and I said, so you a writer? And he smiled and he really got into it. And he said, I'm writing an autobiography. I've been at it for 4 years and I'm a little lost. And I said, to the rescue. So how can I help? You know, and the whole flight was an hour long and we ended up having a fabulous time eye to eye. And it doesn't always work out that way, but I so enjoy those kinds of interactions. They mean a lot to me. And now I think of that connective effort, those words. I think the phrase is fabulous.
Thank you.
Well, because it's also work. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people think that friendships and little niceties just fall in your lap and then you respond, right? But many times you got to work it, right?
Yeah. Some people, when I was first writing this and giving talks, were saying you could call this connective practice or connective. There's other words that we could use. But I actually wanted to call it labor just for what you're talking about, that I wanted to point out that it is a form of work because it was a study that I was doing of people using it at work, therapists, teachers, doctors, et cetera. And I wanted them to be able to talk to their employers, to insurers, to and be like, this is something that is helping create the value that you're paying for. And so we need to make space for it and we need to recognize it and we need to think about how to make it better and we need to train it and, you know, all the things that we do for other kinds of work. And so the use of the word labor was on purpose.
50% of life is just sort of showing up and the other 50% is putting a little thought into how you're showing up, when you're showing up and all the rest of it. But I've read some fabulous research that basically showed that just showing up to that weekly Mahjong or bingo or whatever. They love studying senior communities. That it had the health benefit equal to exercise and clean eating. All right. After I gathered myself off the floor when I read that, I said, what? Because we're always about exercise and nutrition and sleep and all the rest of it. And that's great. That's foundational. But we've sort of blown off the exquisitely critical health benefits of just connecting with other human beings and the meaning and purpose behind that. So the health benefits on all of this, you know, the value of connecting, as you said in one of your chapters.
Yeah, I mean, exactly right. researchers have known this for a little while now. We're talking more than a decade, I would say, that some of this research is going back. And, you know, it's almost like we want it to be a pill, or we even want it to be behavioral modification. And really, it's so much of it is about your social demeanor, your social practice, your social conduct. And we need to not take that for granted. And that's kind of also why in the latter part of the book, I talk about social architecture, because it's not just your individual habits. Our habits are kind of produced by the environments that we walk around in. And so I could see it when I was doing all this research over 5 years with teachers and doctors and therapists, et cetera, that different schools or different clinics did it better, made it more possible for positive social interactions, basically, and more connective labor. Didn't get in the way of the connective labor, or didn't make it harder to do it. Didn't rely on the individual hero to get it done at the end of the day. You know, they made it kind of structurally possible. And that felt like an important contribution to well-being, more than just urging people to maintain your social network, you know?
Now I want to deep dive into something you identify as how to be a human. When we come back, you're going to answer that question. The Her podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to Solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. And we're back. All right. How to be a human? Well, like, what a wild thing to be asking someone. It's like, how to be a human? I don't know. I wake up in the morning, roll out of bed, do my thing. Aren't I a human? What am I missing here?
Well, that was me trying to talk to the people I was interviewing, you know, and observing. I was blessed, really, to have the opportunity to follow around chaplains in a hospital, to come and visit and shadow the employees at an HIV clinic, to, you know, I even was part of a horsemanship weekend dedicated to teaching med students more about the doctor-patient relationship. So I had a lot of, those were just some of the, and mostly medical focused parts of my observational research. And in doing that research, I kind of was coming away with, how do people do this work? How do you do connective labor? And I didn't want to just get, oh, you know, I wash my hands at the beginning. I do, you know, I didn't want to just have a checklist. Instead, I was curious about how do you do this work that's particularly difficult to automate? What are the particularly human characteristics of this work that you do? So for that, I came away with like five different things that are particularly hard for machines and particularly human about this work. And it starts off with, I use as an example, this therapist I talked to named Wanda, who talked about the vibe in the room. You know, I asked her how she knew when she was getting it right. And she says, it's, you just feel it. There's an energy. It gets hot. You know, like she's sounding very woohoo, but actually even very kind of science-oriented, more conventional practitioners, teachers would tell me about their spidey sense, or you just get a sense. And that's the number one of the five, is using the body as an instrument to sense what's happening. And I actually just read today a Johns Hopkins study in which they conducted, I think out of their computer science department, in which they conducted all these experiments to prove that actually AI or large language models that exist today aren't as good as humans at kind of reading the room, getting this kind of vibe sense of the room. So basically corroborating what all my practitioners were telling me. Some other things that were uniquely human that included like spontaneity, collaborating with others. There's a lot that's unpredictable about other human beings. And so being able to kind of do this dance of eliciting someone's opinion, giving yours, forging some kind of agreement, figuring out how to handle conflict, this kind of like give and take that's very collaborative is kind of uniquely human, very difficult for machines to do. I have some other ones, but another one of my favorites is actually making mistakes.
Ooh, I love epic fails.
Yeah.
I'm all about that. I mean, I'm saying just make them entertaining. And now we could turn that into a life lesson, like, ooh, not doing that again, that type of thing. I love the mistake thing. I love going there. And I really enjoyed how you did it. So I think that since this is the Her podcast and we've got a whole lot of women out there, a lot of ovaries rolling around, right? One of the things I always caution women is that the P word, we got to do it perfectly. Everything we do, you know, men are different. I'm going to be so global here, but what the hell, right? And what I have found is that guys are, you love living in the gray zone. They're like, many times when I've studied men, I'm a clinical investigator, you know, what they'll say is they'll say, what's the least I need to do to get the greatest benefit? Okay, a woman will say, how can I make my life more horrible than it is by actually layering on every ounce of perfectionism in any task that you give me? That's the way a woman goes. So I usually have, you know, I'll say something very straightforward. I'll say, what I'd like you to do is start walking. Walk in your beautiful neighborhood. You know, just get out there, do your thing. Okay, a man will go, oh, okay. And then the socks are mismatched. The shoes are beat up. The outfit is a little scary looking. They may have a little extra belly hanging out of the shirt and everything. They don't care. They're just out there. They say, she said to walk. I'm walking. You know, a woman takes an hour and a half. What matches? Everyone will be watching me. I know. This will be like a fashion show. And what will I look like out there? How's my hair? The shoes, are they the best? You know, it just goes on. It's like, no, stop. And I find myself trying to draw women into a beautiful area of just do the best you can and really celebrate falling on your ass every now and then. That's kind of cool stuff. It's like, just dust it off and go, okay, now what I learned. Always, you know, look for that pony in the big pile of you know what, and just find the lesson and enjoy the ride. That's what this is really all about. But women just get so, and I just, so have you found there to be gender differences in how all of this is approached?
Well, the first thing I would say is that women can feel like they get punished for not being perfect. So I
That's
do
correct.
Think that this is not just kind of in your genes or something. It's really how we've socialized ourselves and each other. So there's so much judgment out there. And yeah, that often lands on women pretty toughly. So
the best wife, the best partner, the best mother.
Especially like, about mothering.
Oh,
and, there's a great psychoanalytic writer from the 1974, I think, you know, like a really long time ago, named D.W. Winnicott, I think famous in the 50s, actually. So I think 74 might have been a number printing or something. But anyway, he wrote a book about where he coined the term good enough mothering. And I have walked with that for years because he kind of was saying, you don't have to be perfect. You have to be good enough. And I just feel like that's freeing for so many. And I want to spread the gospel about good enough mothering. In terms of the gender difference around connective labor, because the term itself is not, there's no perfect connective labor. It's just doing your best and trying and making mistakes is part of it. And just as we've been saying. So that's not so much where the gender difference I might see. It's more like it's something that we assume that women do, and we don't see it when it's part of men's jobs, and it is. Like, there are jobs that are largely populated by women and jobs that are largely populated by men. And that's what I mean by men's jobs and women's jobs. And when men's jobs have this seeing, we either don't even notice when they do it. When women's jobs have this seeing, we notice when they don't do it. And we kind of punish them for it. So yeah, it's a thing we assume women do and a thing we ignore that men do. And so yeah. And it also, the way connective labor as an idea, like the idea that it's about seeing the other, that isn't always for other people's well-being. So sometimes it's for, you know, sales or persuading other people, like marketing definitely involves seeing the other person and having them feel seen, not necessarily for their well-being, sometimes just to sell them a product. So I talked to police investigators and detectives about how they decode the other person and that process of decoding them, seeing them and having them feel seen is a form of connective labor. It is not for their well-being. It is for essentially control and security or whatever. So if we think of it in a really expansive way, not in the well-being and kind of that's going to be more in keeping with the healthcare professions, then you can see how men do it for sure. And women do it. And we just don't like kind of talk about it when men do it.
You know, it's interesting. As a physician, I did a tremendous, when I was frontline, you know, it was critical care and that type of thing. And, you know, many times I noticed that I really had to draw it out of people. They were oftentimes afraid to fully reveal. For a lot of reasons, this is especially true for domestic abuse and that type of thing, where you're afraid and back and forth. And I had to talk about labor. You really have to work it in a big way. This is why, you know, my nurses and I really understood what you said in the book. And what you said was that this is the kind of labor that many people blow off. It's like, nah. And you spent that extra time with that individual, that one story, that was amazing. Tell the story about the individual in the ICU who was on the ventilator and he was so anxious and angry. Yeah. That really, really resonated with me.
So I was following around a chaplain in a hospital and she was sitting with a guy, Hiram, and he was intubated. And she's telling me the story. He was intubated and he was kind of full of rage. He didn't want to be intubated. He couldn't speak because of the tube. He couldn't write because of the medication that he was on. He felt kind of impotent and helpless and also very angry. So she comes over to him and she sees he's full of rage. He's saying, he's trying to say, no, 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 and he can't say it. And she hands him a Kleenex box and says, throw this against the wall. Why don't you throw it against the wall? Because it might make you feel better. And in response, he pulls her in and holds on to her. And the next day or 2 days later, he sees her and he says, there is nothing like being seen in one of the worst moments of your life by someone who doesn't even know you. It was a profound moment of solace for him in a terrible occasion of grief and rage. And she was able to convey it, not through the perfect phrase, oh, sounds like you look really angry, but instead just handing him this Kleenex box and showing that she saw how much he had to get that out. So it was like a very powerful moment, but not about having the perfect comment and about how important it is to be seen.
It's so interesting. When I was at the National Institutes of Health, where I did my training, we were dealing with a particular medical issue that involved a surgery of the pituitary gland, sometimes also the adrenal gland, depending upon where these tumors were. And when people came from all over the world, because it was a bit of a rare tumor. And one of the first things I noticed was that obviously, extreme anxiety. I mean, who the heck wants someone messing with their brain, let alone? Yeah. And at the same time, there was the pent-up anxiety, anger, why me? You know, that whole thing was happening. And I thought, And then one of my nurses and I were just, I don't know, like hanging out. Must've been one of those 20-hour days. And we came up with this wild idea. There was a room in the back. This was in the old clinical center. They now have a brand new one. And this room just had a bunch of boxes and nobody ever really went in there. And it was just sort of one of those lost rooms. And I said, why don't we get some like plastic dishes that they can throw like up against a wall or something?
Is that right? No kidding.
Yo, absolutely. Well, I'm a bit of a rebel. Okay, you figured that part out. And I said, let's just not tell the authorities. So one of the patients had come in from another country, and she was absolutely delightful. But boy, was she, you know, she had, the tumors were both in her adrenals and her brain. But, you know, we had great surgeons who was going to have a good outcome and everything. But, you know, it's kind of funkadelic too, right? And so we just joked around and said, hey, you want to throw some dishes against the wall? Kind of get it out of your system. She goes, really? We took her back to the room, kind of looked around like, you know, no one's looking, are they? And she did it. You can hear this pow, pow, you know, some
That's
cheap,
amazing.
You know. Oh, it was so much fun. And she came out of there with this look. She was glowing. She goes, God, that felt good.
That's great.
And she said, thanks a lot, doc. And she went back to her room. And let's just say nobody else knew. So, but that's why, yeah, these strange things happen all the time in medicine. We never talk about them. We kind of keep them to ourselves because we as providers are so close to the pain, and we have to find creative ways to be able to do that connective work. It's labor. And so we labored with our plastic dishes. And I just love that. I love just trying to find ways that work for both of you. And it's so beautiful for both people. So your chaplain felt much better. And certainly the individual in the bed felt so much better. And it was just being recognized, being seen, connected with. Someone got it. It's like that got it thing, right?
Exactly, so right.
Well, speaking of got it, you have a great chapter on doing it right. All right. So how do you build a social architecture that works?
Well, that chapter came about because I had been writing so much about all these individual heroes who were so burnt out or kind of chewed up and spit out by their institutions. But I had some organizations that were doing it right. There were some where people said to me, this is the best job I've ever had, or everyone should get this, I wish. And like, we don't only have to be dreaming of a future in which there's a perfect place out there. These places exist right now. And so I really wanted to tell that story. And yeah, there was a bunch of them, and they all go in this one chapter, in chapter 8. And one of them was a medical clinic that gave 2-hour appointments for their first appointment. And they sent the medical assistant, they had a kind of beefed up medical assistant role, and that person would accompany the patient to the specialists and then come back and report in on what the specialist had said. So there was really a sense of wraparound care. And now there anybody listening is like, how is this possible? What about costs? This seems crazy. But part of it was that the people that they were helping, the patients that were in the clinic, were those who had multiple diagnoses and who used the emergency room a lot. So they actually, by meeting their needs and kind of having them feel seen and going with them to their specialists and just being providing this wraparound care, they actually saved money because they didn't go to the ER and took better care of their health. So their health outcomes were also better. But I spoke to one of those medical assistants, you know, this kind of transformed, kind of beefed up medical assistant role. And she was like, I wish my parents had this. Everyone should have this. And I ended up analyzing not just that clinic, but a school, different institutions that fell in this category. And I found that not only did they give like ample time and ample money, but they also had a couple of other characteristics that showed that helped to create connective labor that was working. And one was a connective culture, like values and rituals and beliefs that people might poo-poo. But if you really entrench, if you demonstrate that you're committed to this throughout, that it's a priority, then the workers don't feel like they have to squeeze it in at the end of the day or whatever. And then also it involved how people were relating to each other. So there were mentors, there was usually a visionary leader, a charismatic leader, and there were these kind of sounding boards that were put into place for people to talk to each other. So these different characteristics, these different factors kind of came together to produce these organizations that could do, that did connective labor well.
This whole book, everything about the book really resonates with a real concern of mine about our society right now, and that is loneliness. We're not that connected anymore. We just aren't at multiple levels. And we already know, the published research is fairly straightforward, that loneliness is deadly to your health and well-being. You know, tantamount to smoking 15 to 20 cigarettes a day, in what it does to your morbidity, mortality. And one of the takeaways I have from your excellent research in your book is to try to heighten awareness in a way in which we see the work that maybe we need to do to connect with people more. And we don't need 6,000 people, you know, in our life. I mean, there are light acquaintances and all the rest of it. And I know the person at the market very well, but I'm not taking them home with me. But it feels so great to see them. So they're part of my whole social biome. Okay. I get that. But at the same time, to be absolutely aware, right, of the ability to be able to see people who are lonely, potentially maybe looking isolated or kind of giving you that vibe, as your dresser said, maybe reaching out more, doing more of that labor, because anything we could do to decrease loneliness, this is important. And so for the whole Her podcast audience out there, we all feel it sometimes. Maybe some of you out there are really struggling with it. This is where being exquisitely aware and mindful of connecting with others and not being afraid of rejection. If someone doesn't want to connect, you know, that's their loss, the way I look at it. It's like, see ya. And then you move on to the next. You just keep trying to make certain to connect, because the darndest things happen when you do that. You just never, ever know. By definition, okay, my last story, you can love this. So when I was in my training and I was one of the attending physicians in a major trauma unit and I was in the medical ICU, they actually had 9 ICUs because it was level 1 trauma. And in this one, it was my first day. I was like looking around like, okay, who's my army? Who's my posse? What are we doing here anyway? And everyone's very friendly and whatever. And of course, there's only one person per room because all hell's breaking out in that room. This is an ICU after all. And then I see this one room over to the side. It's one of my best stories. And what it had was 2 words, medical students, right? And then a big red slash right through it. I thought, oh my God, that is hysterical. They don't want medical students to mess with their patient, and whoever this is, I got to meet. So out comes this woman with super spiky hair. She's got the wild earrings and she's got that look on her face that says, I'm a rebel. And I said, I love your sign. She says, I see one of those little guys near one of my patients. Okay, homicide. That's it. That's where we're going. And she and I became best friends for life because we totally connected. And she turned out to be one of the most compassionate, empathetic providers I had ever met. I mean, she literally was a helicopter provider. She was a nurse practitioner and just absolutely spectacular. And she had connectivity down to a fine science. This was a practice for her because I watched her in her private life, you know, as we hung out with colleagues, whatever it was, she went the extra mile. I never forgot that. And so I use her as a mentor in my mind. I said, you know, can I be as good as she is and all the rest of it? So leaving that then, I want to share as we close this beautiful interview out. Good Lord, I could talk forever with you. Something that you wrote at the end that I loved, okay? Because everyone out there in the Her Podcast land, I'm giving you homework, all right? Connect. Do the work. All right. And remember what you know, one of my mottos, do hard work. Do hard work. And that's just life. It's the way it is. You can't avoid it. No easy things out of here. We're just doing hard work, but it's so worth it. The return on your investment for all of that. Ah, so good. So I'm going to read this. Beautiful words. A deep sense of belonging rests on not just shared sameness, but the purposeful integration across difference. So don't just be hanging out with everybody, you know, who's just like you. Stop that already. All right. We can be helped to connect across difference through seeing each other and organizations, clinics, schools, and neighborhoods can cultivate the social architecture that enables us to see each other better. Our social health depends upon it. I just love that. It's just beautiful. I can't thank you enough for being on the Herb Podcast. You really opened our eyes to what this whole connectivity is about.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And everyone, we've been talking to Dr. Allison Pugh, research professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Her book is kind of amazing, The Last Human Job. The Last Human Job. Yeah, it's called Being Human and Connecting. Just absolutely beautiful. Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay. Allison, we're going to dub you a repeat offender. We'll have you back definitely because we need your wisdom and your beautiful research.
Thank you
and
so much.
Here's another shout out to my sponsor, Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs Rooted in Nature and the new Her Life Stages products. Scope them out at solaray.com. And now take a moment, leave us a review because we love to hear from you. We just sit around the whole team just like, what? Give us a review. We love it, love it, love it. Feedback is where it's at. This has been a full production of Podcast Health. And I want to give you a little reminder. You know, your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So get on out there and carpe diem, seize the day, every single one of you. Thanks for listening and viewing, everyone.